Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. It's a week for Southern fiction from new and established authors. This week I'll be talking with New York Times bestselling author Patty Callahan Henry, whose 10th novel is The Stories We Tell. We'll also hear from debut novelist Laura Lane McNeil, whose new novel is Doll Baby, set in New Orleans in the 1960s. And we'll talk with Lawrence Capel, founder of the Lower Ninth Ward Street Library. Patty Callahan Henry published her first novel, When the Light Breaks, 10 years ago. And she's been on a steady path of writing bestsellers ever since. Her most recent novel is her 10th, The Stories We Tell. Patty lives in Mountain Brook, Alabama with her family, and she was originally a nurse until the birth of her children, when she started writing. And when her daughter confessed that she wanted to be a writer, Patty realized that was her dream as well, and it's certainly come true. Patty Callahan Henry, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Susan. I'm glad to be here.
I enjoyed this novel so much. Tell us a little bit about the plot of The Stories We Tell.
This novel was a little different than my others in that it was the first novel that didn't start with a what if. This novel started with my kind of fascination and obsession with letterpress and also with the mysterious nature of memory and dreams. So the plot of this novel centers around one night where the main character Eve's husband and sister are in a car wreck. And she has to unravel who is telling the truth about what.
And one of the characters, Eve's sister, has a brain injury as a result of that car accident. And you were able to draw on your own nursing background for that, weren't you?
I was. And this is the first novel, out of all 10 of my novels, that I actually did dive into my past career. I've never used my nursing career before, and, you know, I don't know why I haven't, but this was the right book to do so, because this was the book I decided to really, as I said, dive into memories and dreams. And it's fascinating when a head injury occurs. It's not like a broken bone or stitches where you do the same thing every time. Everybody heals differently, and memories return differently, and the brain heals differently. So, yes, this is the first time I used my experience in that field, because that was my specialty. It's come so far since I quit nursing. So mm-hmm. It was fascinating to also research all the new findings and use that in the book.
And it's very hopeful, which is nice, too.
Yes, thank you. It is. And it's because we've come so far with understanding the brain and neuroplasticity and how it heals and what dreams and memories mean and how to help patients heal through creativity. That was one of the messages in the book, is that, you know, when we're injured, either our heart is hurt or our head is hurt, creativity can heal both of those in many ways.
Now, you said you were also inspired by the art of letterpress printing, which I think is so, so lovely. So how did you research that? Did you work in a letterpress operation?
Well, the first thing I did was my dearest friend in Atlanta opened a store that had a letterpress in it. And so I went and I handled it and I used it and I played with it. And then I went and interviewed a professor in Birmingham who teaches letterpress and bookbinding at Samford University. And I interviewed him. And then I went to visit Hat Show Print, which is one of the largest and oldest letterpress companies in the U.S. and took pictures and wandered around and went behind the sign that said, nobody's allowed past this.
I love their work. I really do.
A little bit defiant. And I very much designed Eve's studio after what Hat Show Print looked like mm-hmm. in Nashville. You know, as with any research we do for a book, when we first write it, more ends up in it than should be there to push the story forward. And so we ended up taking a lot of it out. But it still was undergirded the story and was a net to hold the story, all the research I did.
But I think people love it when characters have meaningful work and it informs the story. And you really do a wonderful job at talking about a design project and how images and type rise and work together and what kind of creative interplay goes on among the people in the studio. That's a really satisfying kind of thing to read.
Oh, thank you that you noticed. I do believe that the research we do, whether it's about, you know, dolphins in When Light Breaks or whether it's about letterpress in the stories we tell, that although I'm not telling you everything I learned, you're right, it does inform the story. And the card line that they design in this novel does push the plot forward. And that was something unanticipated, even as the writer of the novel. I knew that that card line was important to their childhood and to the bonding of Willa and Eve's sisterhood, but I didn't see it coming that this card line would also push the plot forward. And that was satisfying as a writer, so I'm thrilled that it was also satisfying as a reader.
And we should also say that the card line you're talking about is 10 good ideas, and it starts off with, be kind, tell good stories, always say goodbye. It's really lovely and thought-provoking and just a kind of a good thing to hold on to.
Thank you.
Now, this novel is set in Savannah, Georgia, which gained fame as well for being the setting for Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. And it's really becoming a kind of storied city, isn't it?
It is. And it's fascinating because I'm in Savannah right now while I'm talking to you. So it's where my daughter goes to school. She goes to SCAD. We spend a lot of our summer over here in a town next to Savannah called Bluffton. One of my dearest friends is Mary Kay Andrews, and she has a book out this summer called Save the Date. And we talk a lot, and we didn't talk about the settings of our novel. And our novels came out 2 weeks apart, both set in Savannah. And, you know, a little bit of kismet, but you're right. I think that the city is just becoming more and more interesting. And we were talking at dinner the other night about why that might be so, why the city has become more interesting and more of a focal point. And I think a lot of it has to do with SCAD really growing the city to be more interesting, which is the Savannah College of Art and Design. But you're right. It is an interesting city. Like New Orleans, it's got a magic about behind it and a little bit of mystery and a little bit of folklore, some root doctors. It's, you know, it's got some of the same flavors.
Once you got root doctors, you know you're on the way.
I know, right? You know you're on your way to New Orleans for sure.
Oh, now what I want to know is, does that daughter of yours still want to be a writer after seeing how hard you work?
Oh, she has absolutely zero interest in being a writer anymore. And it's funny because, you know, she was so emphatic about that at a young age. But I think in looking back, it's because she was always a big reader, and she still is, which is thrilling. But her passion is fashion. So that's what she goes to school for. That's what she does. And she has no interest in sitting down and writing a novel.
We've been talking with Patty Callahan Henry, whose new novel is The Stories We Tell. She'll be appearing Tuesday, July 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. It's her first trip back to New Orleans since before Katrina. Thank you so much, Patty.
Susan, thank you so much for having me. This was a pleasure. I can't wait to see you in New Orleans.
Laura Lane McNeil is a native New Orleanian who always dreamed of writing fiction. After Hurricane Katrina, she set about making that dream come true. And the result is her first novel, Doll Baby, set in New Orleans during the turbulent 60s. It's a pleasure to welcome her to The Reading Life. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Susan. It's so nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, your background is in business, isn't it?
Actually, in advertising and public relations mm-hmm. and marketing.
Mm-hmm. You have an MBA from Tulane?
Right.
And so, what was it about Katrina that made you decide to devote yourself to fiction in a new way?
Ever since I was a little girl, and I actually went to Country Day, and they had this shelf of anyone who had ever gone there and had written a book was on this shelf. And there were only about maybe 6 books on that shelf. But every day in the library, we would look at that shelf. And I said, one day I would like to have a book on that shelf. And I had that dream with me all my life. I said I was going to write a novel at some point. I just always seemed too busy to be able to do it. And then after Katrina, when, you know, everything went to pot and our house was flooded and virtually my slate was wiped clean and I was having to start over, I said, now is when I'm going to start writing this book. I mean, it's now or never. I'm not getting any younger. And this has been my dream. And the other part of it was, you know, when I'm sitting there trying to rebuild my house and the streetlights are dark and it's kind of like the wild, wild west here after Katrina, and all these politicians in far-flung places were saying, well, why should a city below sea level even be rebuilt? And I started thinking, well, we have a lot of history here. It would be a shame if this city wasn't rebuilt. So I just started talking to people, and everybody wanted to talk. You know, everybody wanted to relive their childhood and, you know, the way things were. And that's when I really just started listening, and I started listening to people's stories, and I started thinking about the way I grew up that doesn't exist anymore, you know, the way that we grew up in the 60s and early 70s. And that's how I came up with the premise of this novel, was really took a lot of these stories, that my stories, a lot of other people's stories, and put them in a big pot and mixed them up, and that's how I came up with the story.
Now, this is a novel about a house full of women in New Orleans, all thrown together. And I wonder if you tell us a little bit about Ibby, the young girl who comes of age during the course of this novel.
Well, I had originally come up with the concept of the old house and the secrets in the room. And there's so much in New Orleans that is just, like they say, only in New Orleans, are all our customs. When I was researching the book, I went back and studied folklore, and I studied old New Orleans customs because I wanted to incorporate those all in the book. The novel originally started with her just coming to visit her grandmother every 4 years, and the editor actually wanted me to change it where she didn't leave, so I had to kind of rewrite the whole middle part of the book. But my brother lives in Olympia, Washington, and every time my niece would come in, she would talk about how different the sky looked or how different the people are or how different they speak. And I just listened to what she said. She's 14 now. So I thought, well, that's what I need. I need to bring a young girl from a totally different area, culture, in here to be exposed to it for the first time and see how she deals with it.
And Ibby's one of those characters who's pretty much on her own in an odd way. I mean, her father's died, her mother's abandoned her at her grandmother's house, and Ibby comes of age during this novel and discovers New Orleans, and one of her guides is the doll baby of the title. So tell us about Doll Baby.
Well, the way I structured the characters and the way I modeled Verdelia, Doll Baby, and Queenie, grandmother, daughter, and granddaughter, I wanted to be able to show at that time the three different generations of women, how they had three differing views on what the civil rights meant to them.
Right.
And I also wanted to show, you know, on the other flip side with Fanny, the grandmother, and Ibby, the granddaughter, what their views take was on it, which would be, you know, totally different from theirs. You know, Ibby's is a discovery. Fanny's is a denial. Well, you think she's denying it, and you realize sometimes she really knows what's going on. You know, Queenie doesn't like change. She wants things to stay the way they are because that's easier for her. Doll Baby is pivotal in there because the story is really about Doll Baby and how she gets from one place to another. And in the same sense, for Ibby, through how they guide her and what they tell her, it's her sense of discovery of everything. So they're all intertwined together.
So I wonder if you'd read a little bit for us where Ibby and Doll Baby meet for the first time.
Okay. Ibby wasn't sure what to make of the tall, slender woman standing on the porch by the front door with her hair piled high on her head in a beehive hairdo. Her big eyes were all aflutter, and she was swinging her hips from side to side as she talked. Ibby couldn't make out a word the woman was saying, but one thing she did know for sure, there was something peculiar about her. She came down from the porch and started walking toward Ibby, waving her hand. "Come on now." The woman made her way to the gate and opened it, then bent over until she was eye level with Ibby. That's when Ibby noticed she had one eye as dark as obsidian and the other as light as a washed out sky, a combination that made her pretty face seem off balance somehow. Ibby stared unabashedly. The woman didn't seem to notice, or if she did, she didn't seem to mind. "You Miss Fanny's granddaughter?" The woman blinked several times and smiled a big smile. Ibby kept staring, not quite sure what to make of her. "Girl, you deaf? What you got there?" she asked. The woman tugged at the urn in Ibby's arms. Ibby took a step back and shook her head. Her mother had given her strict instructions to hand the urn over to her grandmother and not to some fast-talking woman waving her hands all over the place. "Okay, then," the woman tapped her foot as if she were thinking. "You hungry?" Ibby had barely eaten in over a week, not since her daddy died. Suddenly, she felt as if fire ants were trying to eat their way out of her stomach. The cockeyed woman stood up. "Well, come on." Before Ibby knew it, she'd grabbed her hand and was pulling her along as if she were a small child. Ibby tried to yank her hand away, but the woman held on tight. The warmth of her hand somehow made Ibby feel at ease. Ibby let go a smile without really meaning to. "Well, that's what I like to see," the woman said as they picked their way past the gnarly branches of the boxwoods and walked up the brick walkway towards the house. "My name's Doll Baby, by the way, but you can call me Doll." Ibby tried to hide the expression on her face at the funny-sounding name. "Got a daughter about your age. Call her Bedelia," Doll went on. Another name Ibby had never heard before. Doll stopped short. "You got a birthday coming up from Miss Fanny tells me, that right?" Ibby drew her hand away. Birthdays weren't celebrated in the Bell household. "No use making a fuss over something everybody has," Vadrine reminded Ibby every year on her birthday. "How old you gonna be?" 12, Ibby said. "I knew it." Ibby looked up, startled. "I knew you could talk."
I love that moment. It just sets the tone for everything to come, doesn't it? We've been talking with Laura Lane McNeil, whose wonderful first novel is The Evocative Doll Baby. You can meet her Thursday, July 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop, or Monday, July 21st at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. This has been such a pleasure.
Lawrence Capel may be relatively new to New Orleans. She moved here in 2010, but she's made a big difference in our city. She was a youth outreach librarian at the New York Public Library, and she is now the school librarian at the International School of Louisiana. While living on $350 a week, she started a library in her home and added to that with a bicycle converted to a bookmobile. Folks in the Ninth Ward call Lawrence the Book Lady, and she's reached out to kids and families in her neighborhood as founder of the Lower Ninth Ward Street Library. Lawrence's efforts received some major recognition June 29th at the American Library Association Convention in Las Vegas, when she received the first Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians Faced with Adversity. Daniel Handler, also known as Lemony Snicket, presented her with a $3,000 check for her library. Lawrence, it is such a pleasure to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what brought you to New Orleans in the first place?
It was several things. I've been to New Orleans on and off over the years, ever since, I think I first came in 1981 for a Rolling Stone concert. And I've been back a couple of times, and it was always magical. And then after Katrina, the American Library Association was the first group to come to do a convention. And I was heartbroken because the New York Public Library no longer had the budget to pay for the tickets for the librarians. So I couldn't make it. And I had really wanted to come and support the city. So as soon as I was able, which was in 2009, I booked a trip to just be a tourist and spend money, because that was the only way I could think of helping. I didn't have any idea how else. And stayed here for a week, which was 10 days, which was the longest I'd ever been here, and completely fell in love with both the place and a musician. And we were trying to be good tourists, my son and I, so we went to a tour place with bus tours, and there was a bus tour of the Lower Ninth Ward, and it was pricey. And I said, okay, well, does any of this money go to the community? Mm-hmm. And the people at the bus tour just looked at me straight in the eyes and went, oh, no, and you wouldn't want these people to have that money anyway.
Oh, my gosh.
And then I came back from Mardi Gras in 2010. And this time I met a friend who was staying in the Lower Ninth as a volunteer. And so he introduced me to the Lower Ninth Ward, and I just completely got taken with the place. And I came back in June of that year and started doing some programming for teenagers at a local community center. And little by little, I just got hooked.
Easy to do, isn't it? But talk about taking your work home with you. You know, you're a school librarian during the day, and you're an all-around community library person the rest of the time. So what is that like?
Well, it's actually really nice because it feeds off of each other. I was a public librarian for 10 years, so being a school librarian is rather different.
That's true. A lot of people don't understand that, but it is.
I really enjoy my work because I enjoy being surrounded by the children, and, you know, that interaction is lovely.
So you started this library. How does this work? How did you set it up and get it moving and get it known throughout the Lower Ninth Ward?
Well, it started because I met a wonderful, remarkable young person who was involved with the Fourth World Movement. And the Fourth World Movement was started by a French priest. And it's the concept of Fourth World being anywhere in the world where there is incredible poverty and lack of education. And that could be anywhere, including in the so-called First World. And so this organization trains volunteers worldwide to go and read with children. And they are active in New Orleans. They're in the 7th Ward. And we have volunteers from Tanzania reading to the children of the 7th Ward, because the 7th Ward is 4th World.
Wow.
So the concept is to pick a public location where the community can see. You know, you don't just take people's children somewhere, mm-hmm. and bring books and set up blankets and just start reading with them one-on-one, and then do a little craft project or something. And that to be consistent, you know. So little by little, the children get used to there's a safe place to go. There's a place where you're going to get attention. There's a place where you're going to have fun. And you're being read to, and you have, you know, a little art project and take something home. So we started this way, and I was volunteering with them in the 7th Ward, and then I thought, okay, well, the 9th Ward really could use that. And I had started just reading to the children in the neighborhood, so we figured, okay, let's find a nice public spot, and we chose my community garden that I had started getting involved with, which is in a nice public corner. And it's attractive, and there was benches, so the lady who runs it was nice enough to let us use it. But the problem was that when it rained or when it's too hot or whatever, or when the winter comes, then we were out of a home. And we started having a lot of kids, especially the ones that I was really trying to reach, which were like the little feral band of children, you know.
Yes.
And we ended up moving into a church for a little while during the winter. And then we ended up moving to a Global Green Holy Cross Project house, which was lovely. But children started coming back to the garden. Where's Miss Lawrence? Where are the books?
Uh-huh.
So Miss Moengo, who runs the Guerrilla Gardens, she's very much into community development. She saw the children needed a place to go and had gotten used for there to be activity at the garden. So she got a grant and started doing programming there all the time. And I'm there monthly the whole year around, and I'm there weekly during the summer bringing books. And then the next thing that happened that was really, really exciting was an organization called Books to Kids heard
yes.
about me.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to me and they said, well, we'd like to do is give you books for the children as long as you promise to give the books to them. And I was like, oh, really? Shoot me, please.
No problem.
So these lovely people just scour the country all year long going to secondhand sales and library sales and church sales. And they buy all kinds of books and they bring them to me and I get to pick what works for me. And so now I have the working relationship for about 2 years. So they got really good. They know what I need
mm-hmm.
and they bring me really good materials. And this way I get a steady supply of books along with other donations. And then every time a child comes to the library or to the garden, or if I put things on the bookmobile, I can just give them away.
So what age group are you serving? All ages?
I really am, because the demand is just, I mean, there's an enormous amount of young children. The younger you can get to the children, the more you know, like, it's really a kick when I get little three-year-old, can I have a book?
There's nothing more fun than giving away a book, because it's so much fun. It really is. And what will you do with the money from the award from Lemony Snicket?
Well, that's a question a lot of people are asking. I would love to be able to include a salary for me and an assistant so I could do this more. What my real dream is if I could get a normal full-time librarian salary for me and then a full-time, you know, minimum wage for somebody to help me drive and carry boxes and a bookmobile. And I would love to do the whole city. I mean, I could do every school that doesn't have a library or a librarian. I could do the shelters, I could do the daycares, I could do the prison. I did all of that in New York City. I'm sure I could do it for New Orleans.
Well, we're lucky to have you. And it's a fine thing to be a book lady, I think.
It really is. I love it. I enjoy myself. It's fun. It's really fun.
Well, we've been talking with Ninth Ward Street Library founder Lawrence Capel, the first winner of the Lemony Snicket Prize for Noble Librarians Faced with Adversity. How I love that name. You can meet her July 10th at 6 o'clock at the New Orleans Healing Center for a free family reading and book giveaway program. Lawrence, congratulations and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Brian Kranz discusses and signs Assault Rifles and Pedophiles, an American love story, Tuesday, July 8th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Laura Lane McNeil, signs Doll Baby, Thursday, July 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. There will be a mystery writers panel with Greg Herron, Bill Lofelm, Gene Redman, and Erica Spindler, Thursday, July 10th at 6 at the Norman Mayer Branch Library. Today's guest, Lawrence Capel, appears Thursday, July 10th at 6 at the New Orleans Healing Center for a free family reading and book giveaway program. Wilton Barnhart signs Look Away, Look Away, Saturday, July 12th from 1 to 3 at Garden District Bookshop. The Jefferson Parish Library will hold two adult spelling bees during July, one at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie and one at the West Bank Regional Library. The first spelling bee takes place Wednesday, July 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library, and the second is set for Wednesday, July 16th at 7 at the West Bank Regional Library. San Fermin in Nueva Orleans comes up this week celebrating its 5th anniversary. It's our version of Pamplona's Running of the Bulls, complete with the Big Easy Roller Girls chasing runners through the streets. Events conclude with El Pobre de Mi, Sunday, July 13th, at the Maison on Frenchman with Hemingway events starting at 1. There will be dramatic readings and skits and a Hemingway look-alike contest, along with appearances by Fleur de Tease and the Ninth Ward Marching Band. Free entertainment, but your bar bills are your own. Poet Lenore Weiss reads from and signs her new book, Two Places, Sunday, July 13th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Today's guest, Patty Callahan Henry, signs The Stories We Tell, Tuesday, July 15th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And don't forget, The Hunt for Waldo is on at various locations uptown throughout the month of July. Get your Waldo passport at Octavia Books and see how many stamps you can gather before the big Where's Waldo party July 31st at 5 at Octavia Books. The big literary and libational event coming up this month is Tales of the Cocktail, July 16th through 20th, headquartered at the Hotel Mont Leon and taking place at various locations throughout the French Quarter. Check out talesofthecocktail.com for tickets and a complete schedule. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.